What an amazing time to be alive. What an amazing time to be watching the news and having conversations about the news and consuming all kinds of bits and pieces and opinions from hither and thither, like a little bower bird pecking around the internet and social media, trying to figure out what's true and what's not. But also, what an amazing time to be susceptible and vulnerable to stridency, to misinformation, to whataboutism, to people trying to distract us from what really matters, jangling keys in front of our face in order to get us to look over here instead of remaining stable and calm and even-keeled about our own opinions, our own vision of the truth. Now is a moment to reach across aisles, to set aside differences, to have faith in democracy, to have faith in bigger ambitions and bigger things to believe in than just the day-to-day. The only way we can do that is by having conversations that resonate with all of us, conversations that make sense to all of us, conversations that are difficult, conversations that are important, conversations that are, as always, a little bit uncomfortable. Today on the show, a terrific individual, an individual with whom I just wish I'd had more time. That was my only regret because, you know, sometimes you speak with someone and they give very short, carefully thought out answers. Kathy is not that sort of a person. Kathy wouldn't do that to you. She wouldn't give you a little soundbite. She will go careening off into her own universe of thoughts about something. And, I have to use all of my stamina just to get a word in edgeways. And I use my journalistically well-approved of technique of interrupting her incessantly to try to get her to shut up about whatever she's talking about and start talking about what I want to talk about. But I don't even want her to talk about what I'm talking about because I'm so intrigued by what she is talking about. That's the kind of vibe of this conversation, which I wanted to have on the basis of her recent article, column, on ARC Digital, which is a sort of a sub-stacky thing. She writes a weekly newsletter. She's a former Boston Globe columnist. She was a weekly columnist also for the Detroit News. She's written in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, I mean, basically everything, right? And now she, like many people, has gone online. She's a contributing editor at Reason, and you know she'll write occasionally at Quillette and places like that, but it's mostly her own gig now. Anyway, her most recent newsletter was called The Problem with COVID Contrarianism. And it was about this phenomenon in the sort of intellectual dark web, you might say, of people who previously prided themselves on being rationalists, independent thinkers, this loose coalition of people from Sam Harris to, I guess, Joe Rogan, maybe Dave Rubin, Barry Weiss, Majid Nawaz, who have now, I mean, if they ever were a community, they clearly are no longer a community. They are riven with, Brett Weinstein, we mentioned, of course, as well in this conversation. They have now fallen apart into a set of camps in which there are the people who are still expressing a fealty to reason and independent inquiry in a genuine way, genuinely curious way, from a place of intellectual humility and good conversational faith. And then there is this other cohort of people who have shamelessly sold out and either should know better or do know better, and are pandering to an audience and captured by their own conspiratorial thinking. Or they're just playing right-wing hacks like Rubin. And in that case, it requires an explanation. What has happened? Why is it so hard to maintain independence of thought during a pandemic? Or maybe why is it so hard to maintain independence of thought ever without tumbling down a rabbit hole and being captured by groupthink? Kathy has thoughts about this. She and I suppose, have occasionally been sort of perceived of as being adjacent to this community of people that's no longer a community, and good riddance to it. And look, I would have talked to Kathy for, we only had, an hour and 15 minutes or something together, and so I kept trying to hurry her up, but she was so fascinating in talking about her early years growing up in the Soviet Union, which, by the way, I think gives her some real insight into the nature of authoritarianism and state power and truth and misinformation. that the first half of this chat is just me talking all about the Soviet Union. So if you get bored of that, just skip forward like half an hour if you want to hear all the COVID related stuff. Stop asking me about Joe Rogan, please. If you are interested in continuing that conversation specifically, make sure you're following me on Twitter, JOSHZEPPS or ZEPPS. That's an intentional misspelling of the name. On Instagram, I'm Josh Sepps, JOSHSZEPS or SZEPS, which is the correct spelling of my name. You can also Google an article that I recently wrote in The Australian about this. You can see a recent appearance of mine on The Drum, which is a panel show, which is available if you're in Australia on ABC iView. That was on last Wednesday, if you're listening to this in real time, so a week ago Wednesday. All I will say, if you can't be bothered finding this on other platforms that I've been talking about it on ad nauseum, is this has clearly transitioned from being perhaps well-meaning, well-intentioned campaign to try to clean up misinformation online into what it perhaps always secretly was, which is a witch hunt against an individual on trumped-up charges, essentially. If you're producing hours and hours and hours and hours of content, and if your whole raison d'etre is to push boundaries and be funny and be a little bit of a bad boy and just shoot the shit with friends and get stoned and smoke cigars, if that's your thing, then out of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of content, people are going to be able to find you occasionally stepping up to the line and crossing over that line. And unless you want to live in a world in which that never happens, in which people who do that are not on public mainstream platforms, this whole thing is a storm in a teacup. I mean, Joe, as I say in this, I can't even remember. I've done so much about this and been asked about it so much, I can't even remember where I'm saying all this now, but it may be in the conversation you're about to hear where I just make the point that he has been tremendously a tremendous force for good in the entertainment industry to almost everyone I know. I don't know anyone who knows him who speaks poorly of him. I speak highly of him. He's been good to me. He's given me encouragement. I just don't think we can be holding each other to, the marquee of Queensbury standards. I mean, do we all have to, is there no space for getting things a little bit messy and getting things a little bit wrong? The misinformation component is being dealt with, by Spotify in ways that Joe seems to condone, like putting warnings on some of the episodes that are the most controversial, or it's striving for greater balance by inviting on more mainstream voices. Fine. But all of this other hoo-ha about stitching together old clips of him saying the N-word or telling racist jokes or being sexist or being intentionally provocative, things that did not cause a stir 10 years ago didn't cause a stir because 10 years ago they were not the same level of transgression as they are today. So to dredge them up and then present them today as if we should hold the person who was doing them 10 years ago to today's standards is incredibly blinkered, incredibly short-sighted. I mean, there are clearly things that we're doing today that in 10 or 20 years' time are going to seem out of step with current norms. I'm sure there are all sorts of things that I'm saying on the show. I mean, I'm sure the casual way in which we abuse animals in concentrated animal feeding operations, where the only objective is to lower the price of a pound of their flesh and shave a fraction of a cent off to maximize profits and to make your clean, washed chicken breast that's sitting there under a fluorescent light in the supermarket as cheap as possible under the cling film. That, I'm pretty sure, in 50 years or 100 years at the most, will be considered a barbarism. And your children's grandchildren will probably think to themselves, how on earth did people live in that society and not spend every day doing everything they could to dismantle that system, or at the very least, not to be complicit in it? And they might say the same thing about the climate chaos that we're all participating in rendering worse and more expensive to fix and more disruptive to everybody's lives in coming decades. Even if you're not a climate change alarmist and you think people have gone overboard, it's very clear that unless you're doing something really proactive about assisting in getting carbon out of the atmosphere through who you vote for and how you live your life, you are contributing to a scenario that's going to be, at best, very expensive and very disruptive to fix and may lead to unintended consequences, like everybody getting just fractionally poorer every year while we have to pour vast resources into fixing this problem after it's too late, and great movements of people are transitioning across South Asia because the monsoons have been disrupted and the rice paddies are no longer providing rice, and people are on boats coming down to Australia, and all of a sudden you're electing more authoritarian leaders because you have to close the borders. I mean, there's going to be so many knock-on effects from the fact that we're just cavalierly flying and driving and burning so many fossil fuels as we currently are, that it will someday be incredible to people that we are paying no attention to it, just as it is currently incredible to us that people in the days of slavery were able to have the cognitive dissonance and walk around thinking they're good people at the same time as they're taking part in a system that is complicit in probably the worst thing that humans have ever done. I use the term slavery very broadly there. Obviously, the Holocaust is a close competitor, but that's a form of slavery in itself. So, I mean, all of that is not to really say anything specific about Joe. It's just to say, can we please get a grip? Can we please, like, take a deep breath? Can we please remember the adage of he who is without sin can cast the first stone, people in glasshouses, and so on and so forth? You don't have to like him. You don't have to listen to him. But a lot of what's going on now, especially with regard to people's claims about COVID misinformation, is bullshit. I mean, I was on a panel show, and you had a bunch of people who were saying that they'd never seen or listened to Joe's show, but they say that they think that it shouldn't be on Spotify because it's spreading misinformation and he has blood on his hands. And they cut me off before I could say what I wanted to say, which is, so let me get this straight. We're sitting here talking about a person whose work we're unfamiliar with, whose show we haven't seen or listened to, who operates on a platform that we don't use, and our gripe with him is that he doesn't do his own research. That's rich. Like, cut it out. At this point, unless you want to live in a stale, boring, authoritarian world where everything is fact-checked and every person is constantly second-guessing themselves in their heads about what is about to come out of their mouth, back off. I don't think anybody actually wants to unleash the kind of world in which Joe Rogan's don't exist. Oh, but he would not exist. He would just, we'd just take, remove him from Spotify. And of course they would cease to exist. They would become fringe elements. It would be a warning. It would be a chilling effect. I used to say, thank God Australia was founded by convicts instead of Puritans. And that may still be the case, or maybe we're all just becoming so puritanical that we're getting so far up our own asses. We've lost sight of what it actually means to be generous anymore. And that doesn't mean that you can't criticize Joe Rogan for not being, I don't know, adequately generous towards the minorities who he's made jokes about. But that's not the point right now. The point is what you do about him. And what kind of person it makes you to take one side or other on the censorship debate, which is fundamentally what it is. We can say it's not about free speech, we can say it's not about censorship, but at the end of the day, it's about who do you want making decisions about who can say what in the public square. Because platforms like Spotify and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter are the new public square. Yes, they're private companies and they can do whatever they want, but the reality is if you boot it off them, you are not functioning in our conversation. So who makes the decision? Do the people who listen to the show make the decision about what they want to consume? And do we set the boundaries of public conversation as capaciously as possible because we believe in an old-fashioned small-l liberal idea that the best outcomes come from the maximum amount of debate and dialogue? Or do we outsource our censorship to 22-year-old software engineers in Silicon Valley riding skateboards who are responding to a Twitter mob that's responding to aging rock stars threatening to pull their music off the platform? But enough about me. Follow me on Twitter, follow me on Instagram, You can Google some of my articles. There'll be some big changes and big opportunities coming. So if you ever don't like a particular episode of this podcast or don't agree with me on something, make sure you are subscribed to the show and at least listen to this first portion of each episode, even if you're not interested in the guest, because things are going to be rolled out that you will not want to miss. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy as much as I did this all over the place chat with the one and only Cathy Young. When did you come to the States?
In 1980, when I was 16 years old. I'm sort of dating myself here. So, I've been here for quite a while.
What was that like?
Oh, it was pretty remarkable. I mean, of course, at the time, this was during the age of communism, so Russia was a very close society. I mean, it wasn't close like North Korea, because there was a lot of stuff the Iron Curtain in some ways was very leaky by then, you know, at least when it comes to information. I mean, I remember there were like Western, at one point there was a copy of Vogue circulating in,
oh, wow.
In my How school, salacious. You know, that sort of thing. And, it wasn't totally closed, but I mean, certainly, and, you know, my parents were sort of closet dissidents who had forbidden literature at home and so on. And,
what sort of forbidden literature was lying around the house?
Solzhenitsyn, emigre writers, that sort of stuff that was critical of the Soviet regime.
Would you get punished for having Solzhenitsyn in the house?
If you got found out, sure. I mean, yeah, because my parents were very careful to warn me, and they started being kind of open with me about political stuff when I was around probably 11 or 12, so at a fairly early age. But I do remember being told, like, very firmly that you're really not supposed to, like, tell anyone at school that we talk about this at home or that we have these books. I was very aware of the fact that political repression was a reality. I mean, in that era, probably, like, if you got busted for having forbidden books, it was more likely that you would lose your job than that you would actually go to prison just for that. But it was still, like, best not to take any risks.
And would you lose your job on some other pretext? Would they find something to hang it on, so that they didn't have to be up front about the fact that they were censoring
it? It was officially forbidden, because there were, at the time, articles in the Soviet Criminal Code that basically penalized, the very, very broadly defined activity intended to subvert the, to subvert the government, or to subvert the state. Anything really, including literature that was not officially approved, could be part of that. The severity with which people got punished for political crimes kind of waxed and waned depending on the climate. I mean, there were moments when they started to crack down. Like when dissent got a little more outspoken, they would start to crack down. It was very, and that was part of why my family left, because things were getting really, in some sense, more unpredictable. And I think they were getting more unpredictable because the regime was getting shakier, because as we know, it collapsed like 10 years after we left, which was amazing. It's funny because I remember there was a Soviet dissident named Andrei Amalric who wrote a book, and I think it was written in like 1970 something, but it was called Will the USSR Survive Until 1984? And of course, he picked the date 1984 because of George Orwell.
Right.
And at the time, it just seemed like this, very theoretical, very abstract question, kind of like, are we going to travel to other constellations someday? that sort of thing. Like, are we going to have colonies on Mars? And then suddenly, he was off by like, and unfortunately, he didn't live to see the day because he died in a car accident, which still, I think to this day, among Russians from that generation of dissidents is still being debated whether it was really an accident or not. But he died in, I think, 1979 or something like that. And, you know, he was off, as it turns out, by like 6-7 years, depending on what you count as like the official.
It's so funny, Kathy, because when I was in my teens, I became fascinated by political philosophy and by the big sort of different ideologies, and this was post the end of the Cold War. But I read like Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, and I read like some primers about the Soviet Union. I just wanted to understand these big ideological battles that had happened. And one of the books that I read had been written in the 80s, and it ended with a coda about communism saying there is no foreseeable way that communism will end. This is the way that the world is now structured into capitalism and communism. So the Soviet Union is here to stay. And I was like, man, it was only a few years later that you were proven so wildly wrong. But it's amazing to parachute into the minds of people in that era and see how
it really did seem very, very kind of frozen in place at the time. And it was very difficult to imagine that it could start liberalizing,
were you in Moscow, or were you in the regions?
Yeah, I was in Moscow. I actually have a book that was published in 1989 called Growing Up in Moscow.
Cool. Do you have memories as a teenager of like Brezhnev and like pre-Gorbachev, pre-opening up, pre-perestroika?
Yeah, it's I should get you a copy of my book, because it's
I'd love to.
A lot of that. And I mean, like we and it's funny again, because it was this very kind of repressive regime and everything, but at school, like, we told Brezhnev jokes. I mean, the Brezhnev jokes just usually just depicted him as a complete moron. Like,
can you tell me a Brezhnev joke? Do you remember a Brezhnev joke?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, to be told properly, which I'm not going to attempt to do, you have to, like, try to convey a speech defect, because by that time, and of course, it really wasn't nice to laugh at that, but apparently it was because he had survived a stroke. But by then,
I don't know about Soviet authoritarianism, but in the modern woke authoritarianism, you will definitely be cancelled for making fun of someone.
Oh yeah, So the Brezhnev jokes, to do it properly, you had to imitate the slurred speech, but I'm not even going to try to do that, especially since it isn't nice, you know. But anyway, so yeah, so one of the jokes, for instance, is that Brezhnev, you know, leaves his apartments for a Politburo meeting in the morning, and you know, he puts on the shoes that his housekeeper puts out for him, and he gets to the Politburo meeting, and somebody says, "Oh, Leonid Ilyich, you're wearing like one black shoe and one brown." And he says, "Oh well, I'm gonna go back to the to the apartment and change." And I flubbed one detail, which is that his housekeeper puts out two pairs of shoes for him to choose from. So he puts on, you know, one black and one brown. So he gets to the Politburo meeting, and somebody says, "You know, you're wearing one black shoe and one brown." He says, "Oh well, I'm gonna go home and change right now." So he goes back to his apartment. And then he comes back to the Politburo conference room, still in one black shoe and one brown. And he says, "You know, I really don't understand what's going on. Like, I went home and it's the same thing over there. One black shoe and one brown."
I don't get it. Yeah. Oh, I see.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
it's much less political than I thought it was going to be.
Most of the Brezhnev jokes were really just
sophisticated, like anti-communist.
No, most of the Brezhnev jokes were really just about depicting him as a moron. And there was another one, because he was always like reading these very long speeches from a piece of paper, and he was reading them in a kind of expressionless, flat way, you know. And all of these speeches were pre-written; they didn't have teleprompters, so he would just very obviously read from a paper. So one joke was that Brezhnev goes to a meeting, and you know, delivers this long, like, like interminable speech. And then after he gets home from the meeting, he calls in his secretary, who is also a speechwriter, and says, "Hey, you know, what's going on? I wanted a speech. I told you I wanted a speech 15 minutes long. And that must have gone on for like at least 45 minutes. And the secretary says, "Oh, but Leonid Ilyich, I gave you 3 coffees. So yeah, those were like that was the general run of Brezhnev jokes. Right, some of them were more overtly political.
Yeah, that is sort of political. That is subversively political in the sense that it's not just that he's stupid.
I mean, I remember that there were no also all these jokes about the, there were all these jokes like, you know, Brezhnev, Nixon. This was back when Nixon was president. So it was Brezhnev, Nixon, and whoever the French leader at the time was. I think Mitterrand? It was Giscard d'Estaing. But yeah, I think it was Brezhnev, Nixon, and Giscard d'Estaing going to a bar. Oh. That was sort of the, you know, a setup for many, many jokes.
I love it. So when you got to the States, what was your, for a start, very quickly, how did your parents get out? And what were your impressions on arriving in the States? Where did you go to initially?
To New York, and my parents got out. This was when Soviet Jews were sort of emigrating en masse. This was when the Jackson-Vanik Amendment was in force, where the Soviet Union had to allow the allow emigration for a certain number of groups, mainly Jews, but there were also other sort of marginalized groups, as we would say today, like Pentecostal Christians who were persecuted, and like a few other groups. So they had to permit the immigration of a certain number of people in order to receive like most favored nation trading status. So, Soviet Jews were allowed to emigrate as part of that. Officially, I think we were supposed to emigrate to Israel. The procedure at the time was that when you got to Vienna, which was the first stop sort of outside the USSR, you spoke to some, you know, people from refugee assistance agencies, because officially we're classified as refugees. You know, which sounds much more dramatic than it actually was. I mean, we were not like fleeing a war or anything like that. But, you know, we did really have to leave behind. Obviously we were able to take luggage with us, but there were like they only allowed you, for instance, to take out a very small amount of money, so you really kind of had to start over with pretty much nothing. Once you got to Vienna, you got a choice of, you know, where you wanted to apply for a visa. And we were, I think the majority of Soviet Jews who were emigrating at the time were going to the U.S. So that's how we got out. We spent, I think, like 3 or 4 months in Italy, which was another official kind of way station, waiting for a visa to the U.S. So we got here on July 1st, 1980. Yeah, you know, 4 days later, it was the 4th of July, and we were kind of freaked out by the fireworks. I mean, you know, it was like, what's going on?
What are these bombs exploding in the sky for fun?
Yeah, like, is this a revolution?
No fireworks in the Soviet Union.
Oh, there were fireworks, yeah. But, I mean, we weren't used to, like, people shooting their own, like, you know, privately owned fireworks. So it was just thing of fireworks going off everywhere was kind of the thing that was really, I think, the most overwhelming, and again, I'm probably not saying anything here that people haven't already said like 100 times, was just the sheer abundance of consumer goods. And and that, of course, our first experience of that was obviously in Vienna, just the experience of going into a store and seeing, like, you know, seeing all this stuff was really, really remarkable.
Because what was there in Moscow? I mean, I appreciate the sense of there being a massive overabundance of consumer goods, even when I go to the United States today from Australia or Western Europe, in the sense that, you know, the supermarket in Australia will have 15 different types of breakfast cereal. And in the States, it'll just be aisle after aisle after aisle of hundreds and hundreds of like rainbow flavored Fruit Loops. There'll be banana and cherry flavored Fruit Loops. They'll be like, and I'm like, really, do we need all this? So I feel like I'm coming from a Soviet, you know, Soviet state when I moved from Vienna to the States.
At the time, this was the era of the food lines. And this was when it was pretty normal, like, to get to a supermarket and there would be like maybe one type of cheese available, like the butter, you know, depending on whether it was a good day or not. I mean, I remember, like, I can tell you that when I was, this was not long before we left, I was probably 16. Like, I went to, like, my mom asked me to go to the supermarket and, you know, just get some basic stuff. So, for instance, like, all the milk cartons were leaky, like, every single one. I spent a long time trying to find a milk carton.
They still are, Kathy. They still are. That stupid design still doesn't work for me. I always end up half the time with a little bit of milk in the bottom of my milk tray.
They had these, I still remember them, they had these triangular milk cartons and they were always leaking. So, anyway.
And were you buying things?
Leaking milk cartons.
Were you buying things with state-issued, like, food vouchers, or did you have, was money?
No, there was money. The state-issued food vouchers, I think, was mainly, like, during World War II,
I think during Stalinism and the Cold War, that was the main way that you bought milk and eggs, wasn't it?
I think only during the war. They did there was money. So, you know.
Well, you're the one from the country, so I suppose I should yield to your authority on that.
But the thing that I remember most from that shopping trip is that, like, all of a sudden there is this crush of humanity, like there is a stampede, like, rushing past me, and I actually got caught in this crowd, and I got a button torn off my coat, and I was like, what's going on? And apparently they had brought out butter, like people had been waiting for that butter was going to be, like, brought out on the shelves, and I got caught in the butter stampede. So, you know, there is something you really can't relate to, and I mean, it was very difficult. For instance, like bananas, for instance, were like this incredible rarity, and I'm like, you know, like today I'm like, oh well, you know, I have some bananas, but they're kind of spotty. I'm gonna throw this out, you know. you know, in the Soviet Union, you could literally, like, people would stand in line, like, for 2 hours to get bananas.
I know.
I'm like, are they really that good? You know, would I stand in line for 2 hours today to get a banana? No.
Well, people stand in line for 2 days to get a new iPhone, which is almost exactly the same as the previous iPhone. So I suppose we all have our bananas, our Soviet bananas. Kathy, I'm just looking at the ration and coupon system in the Soviet Union. I think you might have missed it by leaving too early. It's not earlier, it's later.
From 1983
using coupons.
There was a period of time after we left when things got really bad, and they were getting worse, you know, when we were leaving. By the way, that sort of induced my parents to take the leap. I mean, not that they didn't primarily, like, hate the political system, but it was also the fact that things were getting worse and worse in terms of, like, food availability. And that was in Moscow, by the way, because outside of Moscow, oh my God, like, we at one point, before we left, we decided that my parents primarily decided, because I was 16, decided that they wanted to go and see some of the, like, the there's a bunch of old towns, like, within probably 200 mile radius of Moscow. Or maybe even 100 miles, with a lot of, like, medieval architecture, which was at the time, in really horrible shape. But, you know, that aside, they were these really, really beautiful, like, old Russian towns. So my parents decided that, you know, before we leave, you know, we really want to go see those. But this was outside of Moscow. And my God, like, the living standards and the availability of food, because, oh my God, like, we at one point we literally went into a shop that had complete, like, a food store that had completely empty shelves except for like a stack of boxes of fudge candy. And I mean, the fudge candy was actually kind of good, but you know, you really can't live on fudge.
I love that. You rock up for your butter and bananas and you end up just walking out with a basket of fudge candy. And
there was a saleswoman because, you know, somebody had to be there on staff and, you know, in case somebody wanted to buy the fudge candy. And my mom asked if they were expecting like any food to come in, and she was like, ha, well, you know, if you want to buy food, you will actually have to like line up outside the store at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And because by the time the store will open at 8, you know, people will just pick everything clean right away. And it was completely insane. And a lot of people from outside Moscow, and my mom ran into this when she did food shopping, and she was mainly the one who did food shopping, but you know, people from outside Moscow used to travel on weekends, especially, or you know, retired people who weren't working during the day used to get on the suburban train and go to Moscow to buy food. And then people would like, when people standing in line for food kind of detected the fact that somebody was from out of town who came in to do food shopping, they were often like really, really nasty to them. Like, oh, like you people come in from out of town and, right, you know, pick everything clean and then there's not enough left for us. You know?
Right. It's like anti-immigrant sentiment. Yeah,
so it was
today.
Just very, very dog-eat-dog, which is kind of funny because like the idea that people have of socialism breeding, you know, human solidarity and no, not at all. But
humans
are going to
human. And so, sorry, just to finish that point. So, I mean, this is all fascinating to me, but I want to get onto the present day as well. But from 1983 onwards, there were these colored coupons that everyone would use to go and buy.
There'd be a coupon for sugar,
a coupon for kerosene, a coupon for this. And there's a joke that where the little boy asks his mum, where's Papa? And she says, he's standing in line to get coupons for coupons.
Oh, that's funny.
And lastly, just to clean up the French, this is just aligning all of the, in case people are wondering, the French president in 1980, as you say, was Destin, and then Mitterrand was from 1981 onwards.
And
all that's tidied up.
Who would it have been in like 1972, 73? Because I remember that there were these, like before Watergate, there were these, you know, Brezhnev, Nixon, and, you know, French president.
Let me have a look. French president, this thing was 74 to 81, preceded by Pompidou.
Ah, okay. So some of it must have been Pompidou, but I definitely remember a lot of like, yeah, I think it was.
Pompidou was 69 to 74.
Yeah, and then it was Brezhnev, Ford, and Giscard d'Estaing. I remember those.
Yeah. Amazing. So that's, well, now you've made me desperately want to read your first book, which I didn't even know about, I'm embarrassed to say, Growing Up in Moscow. I know about your second book, which was published in 2000 or thereabouts.
Yeah, 1999, about, Ceasefire. Yeah,
yeah, about, that's right, about issue. Feminism and
yeah,
and equality. And now you write wonderful pieces about, well, how do you describe what you write about? Because I mean, I think it's broadly in the scope of the culture wars.
Oh my goodness, I guess it could be broadly defined as culture wars, I guess.
And
culture war issues.
I mean, your recent piece, we've sort of been circling each other on social media for a long time, and I've been aware of you, and I'm so glad that we could talk now because your latest piece aligns perfectly with the firestorm that I've been involved in in the month since doing
Rogan's show. Yeah, because I heard it's from your Joe Rogan appearance.
Yeah, and your latest piece is called The Problem with COVID Contrarianism. The battle that I had been fighting for much of last year was against this narrative that had become so entrenched in the United States, especially among
the you mean
right
that
wing.
Australia has like become one
well, yeah, that Australia
concentration
has,
camp or something? Yeah.
Well, a concentration camp, and also B, that when governments implement these things, you can never claw them back. That like this, you know, it'll start as a quarantine hotel for people who are coming in from abroad, but soon enough the government will be locking up political dissidents, and you know the border will never reopen, and like the fact that on February 21st the border will reopen to everybody around the world, and that emergency powers are taken in democracies in times of emergency and then relinquished when the emergency ends. It seems to be like just beyond belief for people who are so obsessed with their own libertarianism that they think the state can only ever be fascistic or authoritarian. Anyway, they can see whatever goes on.
Yeah, and you know, I'll tell you one thing that I find really funny, like looking at the commentary from those political quarters, it's like you get all these contradictory narratives. Like one moment it's, oh, well, look, all those countries are reopening, you know, therefore there's absolutely no reason to, you know, close anything down and all those restrictions are stupid. And then in the same breath, it's like, well, how can you allow governments to impose those restrictions? They will never lift them, you know? It's like,
I don't know if people are stupid or just haven't thought it through, but like
motivated reasoning. Motivated reasoning is what it is.
I saw a graph, Kathy, that someone had sent. They thought they were really owning me by sending a graph of Australian COVID cases since the beginning of the pandemic, and it bumped along, you know, sort of at close to zero up until November of 2021. And they had put arrows in where all of the lockdowns had happened. And it was like lockdown, 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 lockdown. And then the arrow goes right up in after November of 2021. The graph goes shooting skyward with COVID infections. And they say, you know, Australia thought its lockdowns had worked, you know, based on the quote unquote science. But where's your science now or something? And I was like, that's because we ended the lockdowns, opened the border, and allowed COVID in. Like, that was the plan. The plan was get everyone vaccinated, get ready, and then when we're ready, then of course we're going to have to join the rest of the world, not remain in lockdown forever. Like, does this person think that we thought that we were going to stay in a state of emergency lockdown forever? Just like think for one second about what the stated purpose of the lockdowns originally was, which was to flatten the curve on hospitals, potentially wait for a vaccine. Like, the graph shows the exact opposite of what the person who's posting the graph thinks it does. It shows that the lockdowns worked, and then there were no more lockdowns, and the COVID cases went up due to, I don't even know what they think that it's proving. Anyway, let's talk about this whole area, because I think you've got an insightful position to come from, because you and I both are not of the establishment. We don't want to just be spouting whatever the authorities tell us to spout mindlessly. We're both quite anti-authority and anti-establishment in some ways, but we're worried about the way that that has bled in the alternative media universe into a certain level of crazy. And I don't know what to make of it, but maybe you do.
I mean, I do think that to some extent, we've all been a little kind of unsettled and, you know, by the pandemic. And I think everyone may have gone a little crazy, you know, sometimes. But no, seriously, like, there has been so much just complete weirdness, you know, from people that I really didn't expect it from, like, you know, Majid Nawaz, who I had a lot of respect for. That was so disappointing. And like, suddenly this guy is spouting these completely bizarre conspiracy theories about, you know, like the whole COVID-19 thing is just engineered to, you know, institute the new world order or whatever, you know, a global surveillance state. I mean, seriously, it's so bizarre. And I mean, the thing that is even more irrational, though, is people, and, you know, again, I've seen people whom I considered to be sort of rational, you know, basically saying that, oh, well, you know, this whole thing was just, you know, ginned up to undermine Trump and keep him from getting reelected. Right. So like the whole world was so committed to, like, you know, preventing Trump from being reelected that, like, they completely upended the global economy.
Yeah, like, I'm glad you say the whole world, Kathy, because one thing that one notices from outside the US is how parochial so much of the squabbles are. The US tends to superimpose its own domestic concerns onto the rest of the world. You know, the American racial struggles between African Americans and white Americans become a proxy for every single struggle all around the world. So you find, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, French, but African, you know, the French thing people that amazes me, though, is that a lot of countries right now really are sort of, you know, imitating what trend that, like, the activists in a lot of other countries are transplanting to their own soil, sometimes in very incongruous ways.
Yeah.
Those American racial categories. And I think that's a very bizarre development.
It's, yeah. I mean, social media makes it easy to sort of join the good, what you perceive as being the good fight. But I mean, so I've always, as a sometime US resident and sometimes non-US resident, and even when I was a US resident, obviously being an outsider in that country, even though I've spent the majority of my professional life, of my adult life in New York, the experience was always one of sort of noticing this cultural behemoth that was had exerted such gravitational pull on its own residents that they sort of could not see out beyond. It's almost like you're living inside a dome when you're in America, and you almost can't quite see out through the dome to the rest of the world. Everything out there becomes just an apparition, which is a projection of your own internecine squabbles, and now as you say, that's now getting exported almost willingly to people around the world. But the COVID thing is interesting because, you know, the people will constantly talk to me about, like, the vaccine adverse reaction schedule in the States and how unreliable it is. So there might actually be many more adverse reactions to vaccines than on the official record. And I'm like, well, maybe in one country. Right. There are, you know, over 100 countries that have active vaccine programs, and they're not all just, I mean, it's not all Senegal. Like, a lot of those countries have really, really robust public health systems and good data collection. So you can say what you want about the American vaccines.
The idea that in today's world, like, with the social media that we have, and, like, with the amount of transparency that exists today, where, you know, anyone can very easily, you know, anyone armed with a cell phone can easily become a whistleblower, that you could have this massive cover up of adverse reactions. I mean, that is really just bizarre.
It's not even in the interests of many powerful people for there to be such a cover up. Like, the heads of hospital systems are not going to be in cahoots with the drug companies. They're going to make money in other ways. Anyway,
the whole COVID conspiracy thing doesn't make really any sense whatsoever, because, you know, who would benefit from this? Like, if the idea that this was engineered, you know, by governments, like, what exactly, like, how would governments benefit from having people sit at home doing nothing?
I think the theory is that if you're a proto-fascist, if you want a new Soviet Union and you want a population to be cowed, and then maybe this is the way to frighten people into becoming obedient, and once you've broken their spirit, then, like, you can do other things and they'll go along like sheep. I think that's the argument. There's just no, I mean, there's no evidence that the virus was created artificially, even if you believe in the lab leak hypothesis.
I do think that, you know, the lab leak story certainly does. I mean, there's a kind of consensus among the sort of dissident, you know, the dissident thinkers, so to speak, like the people who are, you know, vaguely intellectual dark web adjacent. There is a kind of consensus that, oh, well, the lab leaks theory by now is, like, just fully vindicated. From what I can see, I don't think it is. I mean, I think it definitely has much more support today than it had before, but I don't think it's the consensus in mainstream science.
No, it's not. No, I mean, I'm agnostic about it. I think it's entirely possible.
Yeah.
But most infectious disease experts who I've spoken to, who are not, you know, they're not beholden, they're not kowtowing to China, they're not getting money from Beijing, they're not part of, you know, the WHO with political sort of a political need to pander to geopolitics. They just think it's probably more likely that it just yeah. emerged naturally. But sure, it's entirely possible that that they were doing research
into
this. Maybe initially,
I think the media were a little too quick to
absolutely
dismiss it out of hand, and I think that did make them look bad. Although you're going to have to be careful, because when you go back and look at some of the media accounts that have been cited as, here are people just mocking and, completely dismissing the lab leak theory. When you look closely, it turns out that what they were actually referring to in those stories was not the lab leak theory per se, but like claims that the virus was deliberately engineered by the Chinese regime as a bioweapon.
Yes.
So there's a difference. I mean, you often really have to kind of closely parse exactly what people are talking about, because I have seen a lot of claims like that really fall apart when you subject them to a little scrutiny. I did a piece for the Bulwark. When did I do it? This was probably like last February. There was a flurry of articles and comments on the right, basically saying, "Oh, well, it's actually the mainstream media that initially completely dismissed COVID as any kind of threat and, said it was just the flu. And then people started pinning this on Trump. So it's everyone is being horribly unfair to Trump and, blah, blah, blah. And, Trump never said it was a hoax." Yeah, when you look, I actually went back and looked at some of the early media coverage, and it's completely not. I mean, there were a few articles. And I think those articles were rooted primarily, at one point, I think the Kaiser Family Foundation put out a press release, this was late January of 2020, which, in retrospect, of course, it looks very bad, basically saying, we're all worried about COVID, but we really should be more worried about the upcoming flu season. And I think the reason, even for that press release was not so much to be dismissive of COVID, it was to, do a flu vaccination drive, because they were trying to, get more people to get vaccinated for the flu. And I think that was the unfortunate angle that they chose. So a few media outlets kind of picked up on that and ran stories basically saying, people are worried about COVID, but we should really be more worried about the flu. But, the thing is, though, if you look at the overall gist of the media coverage, there were already, in late January, there were quite a few stories that said, this is a serious problem. And, it may very well become a serious problem in the U.S. So, I mean, this was really by no means, uniformly dismissive media coverage. And, you can find, early on, in February of 2020, there was a ton of items in the right-wing media, the Rush Limbaugh show and the radio and the Laura Ingraham on Fox. There was this narrative that was already taking shape that the Democrats and the media are overhyping this COVID thing in order to undermine Trump's chances for re-election by accusing him of mishandling COVID. So that was this whole attitude that, this whole COVID thing is so much hype. That was, that was a right-wing narrative from very early on. So, people rewriting history really doesn't sit
right.
well with me.
Yeah, and I mean, that's also consistent with what we were just saying about the Americanization the superimposition by Americans of the American experience onto the entire globe. Like the idea that a global pandemic would be engineered in some way or reacted to in some way specifically for American electoral purposes. Is
yeah, and I've actually,
peculiar.
You know, I've
everyone
people,
was freaking
you know,
out about it all over
the
world.
That, I was going to point out, one of the countries that had the most kind of hawkish response to COVID was Israel under Netanyahu, who was one of Trump's closest allies. And I've actually said this to people. So, I mean, do you think that Netanyahu engineered this, this really, really strong response to COVID?
It didn't work out
because they
so
had
well
a really harsh lockdown. I mean, do you think
didn't work out well for him. Well, also, I mean, Australia had a centre-right government that was very harsh. New Zealand had a centre-left government that was very harsh. Taiwan went hard. Singapore went hard. South Korea went hard. Like, was that all because of American electoral politics?
I mean,
open your bloody mind. Like, think outside your bubble. I mean, the one thing that I think is worth conceding is a point that you make in your last piece, which is I had not actually realised, coming from a country that, for all of its faults in, you know, having had examples of police overreach and police brutality in enforcing sometimes arcane rules about COVID zero strategies, perhaps after they were useful. With that as a caveat, I would say that Australia has broadly been scientific in the rules that it's imposed and has tried, at least in the largest state, New South Wales, to do lockdowns in a way that actually makes sense epidemiologically, and then to withdraw them as soon as they're no longer needed. I didn't realize that, like, I was watching Bill Maher, and he said that he hasn't been into his office in 2 years. I mean, most people I know are back in their offices in Sydney, and in terms of schools have basically been open in Australia the entire time with a few changes. Children aren't wearing masks. We're not forcing, like, I see videos of, you know, toddlers being forced to wear masks in American schools. There are some jurisdictions in America, some people outside the states might not know this, there are some jurisdictions where kids basically haven't been to school for 2 years and still aren't. And
the ones who do go are still having to wear
masks. And so I understand that if I was an American and I heard an Australian saying that being tough on COVID is a good strategy, in my mind, I might think that that Australian is saying that he supports school closures, masking of children, endless COVID theatre at restaurants and airports, hypocrisy from our leaders like Gavin Newsom going to the French Laundry and Boris Johnson holding parties and so on. So I think this is confusing things, because the culture warriors on the anti-COVID lockdown side definitely have some points in America. It's just not the point that they think they're making when they impose those points on the experience of other countries.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The strongest argument, I think, from the anti-hawk side is that the school closures really were completely misguided. And, I mean, the school closures, I think it was especially kind of ironic in an almost tragic way for progressives to really strongly line up behind these school closures, because, like, the number one priority in these past few years has been racial inequality, and there's data showing racial gaps in performance on various academic tests really have grown wider since the beginning of the pandemic. And, this is primarily because you have in the minority populations, you know, Black and Latino, you have a lot of people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds where, you know, the parents are, you know, really do not have the resources to supervise their kids' homework very closely, to make sure that they're doing the Zoom lessons and so on and so forth, and just really to almost homeschool them to some extent. So, you know, what you have is a situation that really, like, the whole distance learning situation really, I often bristle at the overuse of the word privilege, but, you know, this is a situation that really does empower the privileged more and, you know, further marginalize the disadvantaged, where, you know, these disadvantaged kids really find themselves, you know, deprived of the school resources that were their best opportunity to close those gaps. And that's really tragic. So I think it's very true that, like, the teachers unions, this is hugely ironic, because teachers unions in America are like a mainstay of progressive ideology, and they're always trying to push these, you know, curricula in schools, you know, teaching about privilege and this and that and the other. And, you know, and here they are, like, resisting tooth and nail, in some areas, the reopening of schools and perpetuating a situation that really does you know, hit the disadvantaged hardest. So, you know, and I think there's certainly that is something that, you know, can and should be pointed out, and the progressives should absolutely be hammered on this. But, you know, instead of zeroing in on these very valid issues, you have a lot of the, you know, a lot of people on the right, or, you know, even the center right to some extent, kind of embracing these narratives that are to some extent kind of like dismissive of the whole COVID situation, and kind of, you know, this whole, you know, it's really not such a big deal, and, you know, the panic is really much worse than the disease itself. No, it's not, you know, and, you know, and that is kind of dispiriting, and, you know, I think you probably saw that in my piece, which, you know, we should probably mention to your audience that it's in a kind of an online Substack magazine called ARC Digital, which you can find at ARC Digital, ARCdigital.media. It's on Substack, and I have a sort of, you know, newsletter that exists as part of the magazine.
Yeah, it's great.
So my
latest one is on
COVID contrarianism and its dangers. And one of the people that I sort of critique is Barry Weiss, whom I like, you know, who I sort of generally consider a sort of ally in the culture wars. I mean, I think she's done some great stuff. I think her Substack newsletter has a lot of great material. And I think you've been part of one of her roundtables, right?
Yeah, well, she invited me to write a piece about vaccine mandates. And
I remember that. And that was my general piece, I think she did a good job of, you know, rounding up different views. And I can understand, you know, that mandates are controversial. I mean, I don't, you know, when it comes right down to it, you know, this is like the libertarian in me really kicking in. I mean, I do think that the government mandates, like for everyone to be vaccinated, are really a step too far.
Yeah, me too. I don't believe in a universal mandate where everybody has to get vaccinated. But my point was that I was talking about things like a vaccine requirement to go into indoor dining or to go to nightclubs or something like that, or for certain professions. Like if you're going to be a cop or a teacher or a nurse or a doctor, and my point was basically that.
What do you think of the whole? I mean, I know that you're supposed to be asking me questions, but what do you think of the whole trucker thing? Because I I don't have a problem with saying, you know, if you're a Canadian trucker who's making runs to the United States, you should show proof of vaccination
sure. But I mean, I think, I've been asked about this online, and for people who don't know the story, the fact is that if you're a truck driver, then you have to be vaccinated to cross the border to come into the US. I mean, am I understanding that right?
Yeah.
And so there's a big protest in Canada. But I mean, my general take is that it's a ridiculous rule, because America has never taken COVID seriously domestically. It's had one of the worst performances in terms of the rampant spread of infection and the scale of disease and death. And so it's a little bit, I just think it's a bit rich for America to have any rules about people coming in unvaccinated or COVID
positive. This is actually a Canadian rule.
Canadian rule, so they're not allowed.
Adopted that rule recently, but originally it was a Canadian rule, because basically the Canadians imposed a rule for their, well, both for American truck drivers coming in, but I think primarily it was for Canadian truck drivers who made runs to the United States, and they basically said, you know, if you're making a run to the U.S. and you're coming back, you know, you need to show proof of vaccination.
Oh, I see. Because the way that it was framed for me by someone online was saying, do you think that truck drivers should be allowed to enter the United States if they're unvaccinated? And my point was just, well, everyone should be allowed to. I mean, I think it's ridiculous that when I entered the States a few weeks ago, had to get a negative test. I guess I didn't need to. Did I need to show I was vaccinated? I can't remember. I crossed so many borders. I don't remember all the rules. But I think it's a little bit rich for America to be insisting that everybody who comes in be COVID negative when there's been no serious attempt to do anything real serious at a federal level or a border level about the pathogen in the first place. If it's a Canadian thing, then I would have to think about it. And I guess it would depend on the epidemiology of what the outbreak was like. I mean, if there's a massive outbreak in Detroit or you know, Albany or
I'm not sure about that, because I think Michigan has always had pretty bad COVID numbers. I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. Yeah. I mean, on so the other hand, then I feel like
maybe entirely rational.
Omicron is also,
at the very least, I really don't. This is the kind of thing that I really find it difficult to see as some sort of like outrageous government overreach. I mean, you know, there. I mean, even I know that there are libertarians who are like completely open or, you know, non-existent borders, but I mean, that's a bridge too far. Mm.
I mean, I understand that.
And if
that,
you
like,
do believe
people...
in some amount of border controls, then I think it's entirely sensible to say that, you know, we can decide that. And I mean, Canada has generally done a much better job than the U.S. of containing the virus.
Yeah.
So I can sort of see them saying, well, you know, we don't really want people coming in from America, you know, bringing this.
Also, here. I mean, if you live in a jurisdiction, and there are some Canadian jurisdictions that are very strict, if you live in a jurisdiction that's going to opt for, you know, strict lockdowns when epidemics get out of control, then it's a bit unfair for other people to be recklessly, you know, not doing the absolute minimum that they could do, which is to get vaccinated, to lower their chance of getting sick and being infectious. Like, if you know, why should someone impose that cost on the rest of society by increasing the chance that there's going to have to be a lockdown?
Yeah.
On the other hand, I then think Omicron is so infectious that vaccines, you know, even if everyone's vaccinated, it's not doing a terribly good job of stopping
right.
the spread of the infection. It's doing a great job of keeping people out of hospital, but it's not doing a great job of spreading infection. So then are you just, you know, are we sort of using Delta tools to fight Omicron? Are we fighting the last battle?
I mean, you
mentioned that the way that you open your piece that your most recent piece in ARC Digital is talking about how you think there's a new battle of the pandemic breaking out, and you cite the Spotify controversy over Joe Rogan and COVID misinformation on.
Yeah, well, there's
podcast.
A new battle of retail. There's always, yeah. So, and I mean, my basic point, and I mean, I think the Joe Rogan situation is very complicated, and now they're also going after him with this, you know, old like racial stuff from the old episodes that he did, and it really does at this point, I think, look like a witch hunt. So, you know, I'm certainly not like in favor of booting him from Spotify. So, you know, but my point and the thing that I was concerned about, and this is also where my criticism of Barry Weiss comes in, I mean, I think there really is in certain, I guess what I would call sort of dissident circles and dissident with regard to the kind of mainstream progressivism that seems to be the dominant like strain of thought in most center-left American media today. And then you have this sort of dissent from the mainstream that's exemplified by people like Barry Weiss, for instance, or, you know, or Joe Rogan. You know, and I think that this dissent is absolutely good and essential to a healthy dialogue, you know, because I do think that there's a tremendous amount of groupthink and kind of knee-jerk political, you know, dogma in the American media right now. And I absolutely welcome the sort of dissent and the debate. But the sort of rejection of conventional wisdom can become a knee-jerk contrarianism. And that's what I was writing about, where suddenly, like, people are sort of embracing I guess non-mainstream ideas about COVID, really just because they're non-mainstream, and really because there's this assumption that, oh, well, anything mainstream is really just the establishment trying to force its dogma down your throat. And that is really just not the case with COVID, I think. And I think we have seen that this contrarianism, it really is leading people to embrace not only really bizarre conspiracy theories. And I think if you look at James Lindsay, you know, that's just a, you know, walking disaster area where, you know, he's really pretty much ended up endorsing the idea that the pandemic was engineered as part of some, you know, sort of conspiracy to institute a new world order, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm really not even paying that much attention to him these days because I think he's just, you know, gone completely, you know, round the bend or, you know, whatever. I don't need to tell you that some of the people that Joe Rogan has amplified in his show are really, really, like, you know, people who are way out there when it comes to scientific information. And I do think that the vaccine skeptical propaganda really is quite dangerous. I mean, the idea, and I mean, I know that, you know, and I really don't mean to dump on Joe Rogan. I mean, I don't think he sets out to be, someone who subverts the vaccination effort or whatever. No, definitely not.
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, I've been asked my opinion on this endlessly, and I've been on TV shows and radio shows and written in print about the whole thing, and I'm generally supportive of Joe, and I mean he's been extremely generous to me and my colleagues. He's been very, very supportive and an enormous force for good in the worlds of entertainment and comedy and podcasting on an individual level, but even on a broader social level, for all of his flaws, I do think that he's I make a distinction between some of these people in the alternative media ecosystem who really are just persistent fire hoses of misinformation, and they are willfully pumping out things that if they don't know are untrue, they should know are untrue. Whereas I see Joe as more of a clown, a ringmaster, a curious puppy who is perhaps too credulous at times and doesn't have, you know, journalistic standards, and so is just chatting with people, and that can go off the rails, and that can, you know, that can exhibit his own biases and his own preference for conspiratorial thinking sometimes. But a person who's trying to deal with people in good faith and who's trying to do the right thing and is trying to be generally correct. Again, that's not to excuse him, but I mean, everyone keeps asking me to sort of throw him under a bus, and I just won't do it because I think there's a huge difference. But let's wrap here with your thoughts about why he is unique and why even someone like Sam Harris, I think, is unique in being a stand-up person who has refused to I guess go down the crazy rabbit hole that you're writing about, because it is striking to me. I got an email from someone who I don't know, who was pointing out that I did an event with the so-called intellectual dark web people in Sydney that went south, and this illustrious collection of people. It was Eric Weinstein, Brett Weinstein, Majid Nawaz, Douglas Murray, and Sam Harris, and I was moderating it, a full day thing. And this person who was emailing me was saying, like, look at that rundown now, look at that lineup of people. And this person was saying, I knew at the time that if you believed that wokeness was a sickness that was coming to take our entire society over, then it was obvious to me, this person was writing to me saying, that was such a blinkered, sort of privileged, inside-the-bubble concern, because this person lives in the Southeast United States, where it was like, this was obviously stupid right-wing hysteria to me that liberals had bought into, because they don't actually know what it's like inland from their coastal bubbles, where wokeness is just, you know, not a thing out here. And this person was saying, like, it's completely unsurprising to him that suspicion of wokeness has now ballooned into a truly crazy suspicion of basically everything, and the only standout exception to that is Sam.
That is very true.
In that group,
that is very true. And you know, I'm going to say that I think to some extent the quote unquote woke establishment, I think, is to blame for for sort of instigating this kind of mistrust, because I do think that on some issues, like even on issues related to science, I think there has been a tendency to kind of subordinate science to ideology that really does generate this this very skeptical attitude. And I mean, some of the discourse around transgender issues, which, you know, and I should say, you know, obviously I fully support, you know, civil rights for transgender people. But when we have scientific magazines trying to sell the idea that, you know, well, you know, there really isn't such a thing as sexual dimorphism, and it's more complicated than that, because, you know, what about the, you know, tiny percentage of people with, you know, congenital chromosomal or, you know, other, you know, anatomical, you know, abnormalities, and don't they really, like, call into question the existence of two sexes? No, they really don't, you know, and I think that's, you know, that kind of thing really makes people feel like, well, you know, science is being co-opted by ideology. And I think because of that, it's sort of easier for some people to believe that, you know, the scientific establishment is playing politics with COVID. Although, again, my question would be, like, why? There isn't anything particularly woke about, you know, about COVID-19. I mean, as I pointed out, there isn't anything particularly woke about, for instance, calling for lockdowns or calling for, like, you know, really strict, you know, policies to contain, you know, and mitigate the spread of the virus. I mean, I even pointed out in my newsletter that some of these measures really went counter to certain progressive values. Like, there were a lot of concerns that were expressed early in the pandemic that the lockdowns were really bad for working moms because, you know, because kids were not in school, you know, kids were not in daycare. And there were a lot of people saying that, you know, the effects of this pandemic and the lockdowns are going to be really terrible for gender equality. So, I mean, this is really not a woke thing. I mean, there is no, like, woke agenda that is being pursued by people who are saying that the COVID, you know, or were saying from the beginning that COVID-19 is something that needs to be taken very seriously. And, you know, and yet there really was, I think, almost from the beginning, this sort of culture war, you know, polarization, where there were a lot of people on the right who, you know, who have been trying all along to minimize this and to say that, well, you know, not such a big deal unless you're, like, really, really old or, you know, incredibly sick, and, you know, otherwise you're going to be fine and you should just live your life as, you know, as usual. And I mean, by the way, I always thought this idea that we could, and this was, of course, the Great Barrington Declaration, that we can somehow, you know, isolate the vulnerable and let everyone else lead a normal life. I never really got that. Like, how do you?
Well, what are you going to do? Like, how are you? So you're never going to see your grandparents in an aged care facility?
Yeah, and I think, like, the Great Barrington Declaration actually suggested. I'll have to go back and look it up. I mean, I think they actually suggested, like, moving all of the elderly and, you know, immunocompromised people into, like, you know, some sort of facilities for the duration of, like, 3 or 4 months.
Well, and, I mean, also, for how long? Like, what happens after three or four months?
Why wouldn't it be a libertarian thing, you know?
But why wouldn't it be 3 or 4 decades? I mean, this thing is not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, that's exactly insane. I mean, and if you look at how many Americans, for instance, have pre-existing conditions that make them vulnerable to COVID, you know, just obesity and hypertension thing. I mean, you'd really have to, like, move, well, you know, 1/3 of the population into concentration camps.
I think you would just have to.
That's not very libertarian.
you would just have to create another Mason-Dixon line and just sort of divide America into civil war.
I mean, this idea that you could only protect the vulnerable.
The fat people in the South can stay there protected, and the skinny people in the North.
Oh, God, we're being very politically incorrect here. Kathy, I don't know if we're offending conservatives or progressives more at this point.
You know, Kathy, I can't wait. I can't wait to read about your childhood in Moscow. I'm going to have to let you go.
Yeah, so, and if I can just finish, like, one real quick point. So one issue, because I started saying something about Barry Weiss, and I didn't want to leave this hanging, just, you know, just to sort of randomly, like, I didn't want to do this, like, drive-by.
Do a drive-by, yeah. No, but very quickly, 60 seconds.
I think she did some really good, the roundtable on mandates that you were a part of. That was really good. But, you know, I did notice, like, in recent weeks, there has definitely been a slant to a lot of what she runs in her newsletter that is kind of, you know, a little, sort of much more favorable to vaccine skepticism than I'm comfortable with. And that's especially ironic because, of course, the gist of her, I mean, you probably know about her appearance on Bill Maher, where she did this, you know, oh, I'm done with COVID thing. And she was very frustrated that, you know, we were told that once you got vaccinated, everything would be fine and you could just go and, you know, lead a normal life. And that didn't pan out that way. Okay, but I mean, if that is the, and I think we're all, the vast majority of people are frustrated that it didn't pan out.
Yeah.
And I think all of
frustrated. Really, I mean, I would certainly be frustrated if I was living in California.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're all happy that we were sort of venturing outside and, you know, going to, you know, restaurants again and meeting up with friends. And then suddenly, boom, you know, we're back to, you know, to something much more stringent.
Kathy, I'm going to lose this line in 30 seconds. So I have to love you.
Yeah.
And,
just my point is that it's if you really want to go back to a normal life, vaccination is the key, obviously. So
yeah, yeah, exactly. That's right. It's not an imposition. It's actually the path to normal.
The sympathy for the vaccine averse is just mysterious.
Kathy, thank you for joining us. Arc Digital is where people can find you. ArcDigital.media. You take care.
Well, thank you.
Uncomfortable Conversations is produced by Stefan Postuma. Follow me, Josh Sepps, on Twitter and Instagram for all the latest. May your day be fruitful, your mind humble, your enemies generous, and your conversations perfectly, sparklingly, delectably uncomfortable.